Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I am Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law in North Carolina. Today is July 12, 2012. Thank you to all of our listeners. We have been increasing our listenership or viewership, and that may be due to the social networks. If you would like to be part of this educational movement, creating ways of awareness, tell your friends to listen to the show, and we will impart all of this information. Alan is the person who digs deeply in, does all the research as to what's happening in the world regarding vaccines, vaccinations, your legal rights regarding those medical methods that are going to be imposed more and more in our world as it becomes the most popular preventative method of preventing disease, supposedly. So if you would like, get out on the Twitter and tweet the show, post it with the share button on Facebook, put it up to dig, and maybe it'll go viral. Put it on StumbleUpon, Reddit, or MySpace. I don't know who goes there anymore. And embed the show after it's finished onto your website or blog. I was so pleased yesterday to see that somebody had done that on one of the shows, and it's very encouraging. So we are going to get started. I would like to introduce Alan Phillips, who is the nation's leading vaccine rights attorney, advising individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States about vaccine exemptions and waiver rights. He also supports legislative initiatives, and we learn about that firsthand before anybody else does on this show. So that's why you need to come here and listen. So, okay, Alan, we are going to be taking news from your website, pandemicresponseproject.com. There is a place where there is news, and that's what we're going to take the articles of discussion today.
Well, Debbie, good afternoon. Pleasure to be here with you, as always. And again, as always, never ceases to amaze me how there's so much more to talk about than there is time to talk about. I want to talk about a couple of quick things first, and then we'll dive into something a little thicker. But there's a recent article here. The title of the article is "Washington Hospital Worker May Have Exposed Hundreds to Pertussis." Now, I'm gonna make a small confession here, Debbie. I'm selective about the articles I post on the Pandemic Response Project's news page. There's lots of information sources out there in the alternative vaccine community to get an overview of all the different things that are going on. I pull mostly those items that have some direct bearing on vaccine politics and law, and less so on more purely medical issues, because there are other experts out there better qualified to delve into those issues, but also because I'm more in the, okay, now we know there's a problem, what do we do about it camp, which is why I'm so proactive in my own legislative activism and in encouraging others to do the same in whatever way works for them. And I will often not put articles that look like they're kind of mainstream pro-vaccine articles. That kind of information is readily available anywhere and everywhere that anybody wants to find it. So I try to fill in the gap with the information that is often overlooked or deliberately avoided by mainstream news. This article sounded like one of those articles, but I read it anyway, and it has some really interesting, useful information for us. In one piece in particular, this is about a hospital worker in Everett, Washington, Washington State, at the Providence Regional Medical Center, and the employee complained about a cough, and test results later confirmed that the employee was infected with whooping cough. So the employee had whooping cough and was around other employees and patients, and so their concern, legitimately, to certainly to a point, is that the worker may have exposed many people to pertussis, and so any number of them could potentially come down with the illness. To the extent that they're not vaccinated, if vaccines work, and to the extent that those who are vaccinated, if the do the vaccines work? Now, there's two separate questions to do vaccines work, and I don't want to get too deep into this here because there's other things we need to
We'll be able to jump over to that other article afterward, Heidi Stevenson's article, kind of as a segue into that.
Terrific. But there's a larger question that we'll save for another time or maybe another show about what's the validity of the whole theory of vaccination in the first place. Does the production of antibodies through vaccines really equal immunity or not? But even let's assume for the moment that it does. The health officials readily admit that vaccines don't work in every vaccine recipient. That is, not every person who's vaccinated has the at least in the mainstream view, desired antibody creation or generation response. What was interesting to me in this article is that rather than sort of really play up some of the mainstream views and myths, there wasn't anything in here saying that I recall seeing in the article whether or not this employee was vaccinated.
Yes, but what it does. He was.
Was vaccinated. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what the point that they made, thank you for that correction, but the point they made that was really interesting to me, and the person talking here is a Dr. Rall,
yep,
who is the head of infectious disease at the hospital, so someone who supposedly is, you know, quite an expert in the issue here. He points out that in 20-30% of cases, the vaccine may not be fully protective. That's kind of a soft way of saying in as many as 30% of vaccine recipients, the vaccine may not generate the desired result. There may not be a protective effect. It's sort of interesting because one of the things that the vaccine community does to sort of hedge its bet is to say the vaccines work most of the time, but even when they don't work, if you get the disease, it's a milder case of the disease, as though medically that a few antibodies is better than none, and that'll make the disease less
well, I assume legally that healthcare workers who are in the hospital are required to get a number of vaccines, whooping cough, DPT being one of them. And also just to note that the reason that a person could go into the hospital as a healthcare worker with a disease is because initially the symptoms are very similar to just a regular cold, which would be a runny nose, sneezing, mild cough, and a low-grade fever. A lot of times people feel like they have to go in to work when they have a fever, which is the time when they shouldn't, but the disease may even be infectious before the fever is knowledgeable, the person recognizes they have a fever.
Well, just a quick clarification point. I've noticed over the last couple of years I've had a tremendous growth in my private practice in terms of having healthcare workers as clients. So there has been nationally a very strong movement that is still playing out as hospitals increasingly are implementing vaccine mandates. Mostly that's been flu shot mandates, but others, some hospitals are starting to get into MMR or DTaP or TDAP or whatever it is, whatever version or variation, but to require more vaccines. And as we've mentioned before, I had a figure that at this point is from a couple of years ago that there were over 330 vaccines either already on the market or in development. So there is no light at the end of the tunnel. More and more people are being required to get vaccines that were not required to get them before, and everyone who's required to get vaccines is being required to get more vaccines. So this is going to keep going, and none of us are outside of the sights of the CDC. Some of us are being, and the adult population in particular, are being targeted sooner than others, and right now it's primarily healthcare workers and others in the healthcare community, pharmacists, and even the vendors who go in the hospitals to sell equipment now are being required to get flu shots, or they can't go into the hospitals to sell hospital technology. It's just medical technology. It's just sort of...
And people should know that they shouldn't really get their vaccination if they are either not feeling well or highly stressed, because that is going to compound the problem with the person getting that vaccine, that they might have a repercussion, a not being well after getting the vaccine if they are really under a lot of stress in that situation. The time of vaccine.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting to me because there's an argument there that cuts both ways. You know, that you have patients or people who, for let's say, are immunocompromised, and the conventional medical view is all the more reason to get a vaccine because you're even more vulnerable to contracting an infectious disease than other people. And they just conveniently ignore the fact that that condition may also make them more susceptible to a severe vaccine reaction. So, you know, we'll see how this plays out over time in the larger vaccine controversy, but it is kind of interesting that the same reason for doing vaccines might be a reason to avoid them.
Okay, now you have an article from Gaia Health, that's Heidi Stevenson, which says, vaccine theory proven wrong, study by NIH. And it's talking all about the jab, that's what it's called, and the assumption that antibodies are necessary to combat viral diseases has been taken as fact. Well, we're going to see what happens over the next decade about that particular issue, and we're going to be questioning whether the number of vaccines is going to be acceptable to the human body and whether the human body can cope with that amount of toxins being put into it, especially if it accumulates, the bioaccumulates the ingredients, which are such a long list. We've talked about that many times. So what does she say here? This is the one from Gaia Health that's talks about vaccine theory proven wrong by the NIH.
You know, this is an issue that has come up in one form or another repeatedly over time. An article of mine that I wrote back in the 90s called Dispelling Vaccination Myths, I encountered information early on in my research and personal research into the matter beginning in the early 90s. There is actually a rare medical condition. I was just trying to look for the name of it and couldn't find it. Agammaglobulin anemia or something like that, that some children have, but the bottom line is their bodies are not capable of producing antibodies. And these children contract and recover from infectious diseases a little slower than, according to the information I found, than healthy, normal healthy children. But the point was is that you don't necessarily have to have antibodies to fend off or recover from an infectious disease. This is one part of a multifaceted immune system that we have, amazing system here. And it calls into question the whole basis for vaccination. Do antibodies equal immunity? And there was... I have also discovered in my research, private research, that some sources claim you can see a difference under the microscope between natural disease antibodies and the disease and the vaccine-induced antibodies. It's not the same antibodies. Now, presumably, it's close enough to protect from the disease. But then there's a whole separate question, and I think as a homeopath, you may appreciate this and have deeper insight on it than me, Debbie. A lot of times, some people have said that vaccines, when they serve to prevent someone who gets exposed to a disease from manifesting symptoms, which is easy for most people to interpret as, oh, it prevented the disease, it may not actually prevent the disease. What it may do is prevent the body merely from manifesting the normal outward acute symptoms. That is, it can actually suppress the disease rather than prevent it. And in this act of suppressing it, it may manifest at a later date in a more chronic form. There's a form of measles called atypical measles that shows up in vaccinated children, which is more difficult to diagnose and more serious in terms of its impact on the health of a person, and may actually be a consequence of the measles vaccine itself, for example. And I believe that this is the sort of thing that potentially could be shown clinically in the practice of homeopathy, where in effect you treat homeopathically, and I'm out of my element here, Debbie, so please confirm or clarify this, but you can approach, as I understand it, where you in effect sort of peel off layers backwards in time, so to speak. If you antidote a vaccine and you with homeopathy and you see an improvement in the health, that would be clinical evidence that a vaccine caused a health problem, would it not?
Well, that's a complicated issue. We've got right here in the chat, Dr. Bob is talking about the IgG subclass immunity syndrome, the immunoglobulin G. And my take on it is that humans, as is the entire environment and all living organisms, are very complex. We're multifaceted. We have lots of things that affect us and we respond to in an enormous number of ways. Sometimes a person gets a diagnosis for a disease and they are told that this is going to happen to you, you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then that doesn't pan out as they were told. They maybe have a really strong immune system or their body knows how to work around it and they're fine. This happened to my grandson who is missing part of his brain. We thought that he would not be functional, and he's a superstar sports person, and he's very bright and great in math, and he's missing part of his brain. And as a matter of fact, the corpus callosum, the part that connects the left and right half, is totally missing. So we cannot predict how the body is going to really behave. And of course, it's nice to be able to target, let's say, okay, we see under the microscope these bugs, germs, viruses, antibodies, and this is our answer. But I don't think that we can really do it. I think that the body has its own innate wisdom to be able to cope with stresses. But then when we impose so many stresses that it collapses under the weight of those stresses, then it's going to be more difficult. And that's what we're talking about each week in terms of vaccines, that we need to get educated and learn what our rights are and make decisions for ourselves. Regarding the immunoglobulin G, it's an antibody isotope, and it's a protein complex composed of 4 peptide chains and very intricate chemistry going on. And then you're saying that there are children who have this ability of not being able to have this type of immunoglobulin, and I'm going to have to research this just a little bit more because Dr. Bob gave me a little bit of information to go by. And if we look at the immune system, it consists of 2 functional components, the innate and the adaptive immune system. The innate immune system prevents penetration and spread of many infectious agents by means of a variety of physical, biochemical, and cellular barriers. That's the skin, the mucosa, the lysosomes, complement, and phagocytes. Those are medical terms. And what we need to know is by bypassing all of our natural immune system, our natural barriers, we're forcing the body to do something that it's not able to cope with. Okay, apart from these first lines of defense, the adaptive immune system may be called upon to react against and clear harmful agents. After the first attack, the adaptive immune system develops specific immunological memory, leading to a stronger, faster, and more effective response upon renewed contact with the same agent. So that's why natural immunity is so good for us. And what the medical industry is trying to do is impose an artificial disease, which is exactly what homeopathy does, but homeopathy takes an energy a minute minimum dose so that the body recognizes the energy and creates a secondary response of its own as a creative healing force, rather than forcing the body to create these immunoglobulin and antibodies. So that's the technical part of it. And you asked me now your last question. You might repeat it for me because I probably didn't answer it yet.
Had to do, I think, with the clinical practice of homeopathy as a way of verifying connection between a vaccine and a chronic condition. That is, if you homeopathically antidote a vaccine, that and if that then results in an improvement of a condition, that would be evidence that indeed the vaccine was the cause of the condition.
I cannot say positively on that. I can say that there are a number of homeopaths in the world who use what is called isopathy, which is the same. Homeopathy is similar. So homeopathy is based on an analysis and observation of symptoms that the person is able to display and express, both verbally, communicate their fears, their feelings, how it feels to them, their sensations, even their delusions, as well as all the clinical aspects, the lab tests and the physical history, the tendencies, and you know whether they're having a fever or a rash or those types of things. So homeopathy is looking at the total picture of what the symptom picture is and then selecting a remedy that will match that symptom picture. Isopathy, what you're talking about, is giving a minimum dose, a homeopathic energized minimum potentized dose of the drug, of the vaccine, as a way for the body to heal itself. And this is being used, and it does work, as far as I know. So it's a little bit different. Does that help to answer that question?
It does, and a little more technical answer than I was looking for. I did find the reference, not the reference, but the site here. This is in my Dispelling Vaccination Myths article. The condition is called agamma globulin anemia. And okay. Agamma globulin anemic children are incapable of producing antibodies if they recover from an infectious disease almost as quickly as other children. So that was a particular point there. Well, listen, let me give a real quick, I want to read just the opening line in this article because it's a good general summary of the issue here, and let's move on because there's so many points here to hopefully get to today. But vaccine theory proven wrong, study by NIH, National Institutes of Health, by Heidi Stevenson. The assumption that antibodies are necessary to combat viral diseases has been taken as fact. This study, though, turns that assumption on its ear. Vaccines may, in fact, work against the body's ability to combat disease. Again, that's not a new argument, but apparently there's a new study supporting that. And so we will see, it doesn't take a crystal ball to make this prediction, we will see the pharmaceutical industry ignore or deny studies like this. There's a tendency when a study doesn't support the agenda of industry for the study to either be denied or to be deemed a bad study on the basis of its conclusions, foregone conclusion that the study is a bad study if it comes up with the wrong answer. And so that's how, you know, part of the politics about how all this plays out.
Mm-hmm.
True science,
when they do the investigation from their hypothesis, whether it is right or whether it's wrong, that's accepted. That's true science. That's informative. If something doesn't work, that's information. It's educational, and they know where to go from that step. But if it supports it, the hypothesis, that's good too. I mean, both are good, but then you have to take the action of legally in what are we going to do with this information. I've lost my train of thought here. So you go ahead.
Well, there's so many different parts and pieces. This is all very complex stuff. I'm going to go on to another article, if I may, Debbie,
Okay.
Hopefully this will be just a really quick discussion, but it's an interesting one. Because we talked a week or two ago about how interesting it is that we keep seeing information about a new vaccine for this and a new vaccine for that. And we had a vaccine that was actually for male pigs to keep them the meat from smelling. In effect, it's a and they were using a quote-unquote harmless virus or something to that effect. It was something that had to do with the pig's immune system. So it was in fact a vaccine, but in effect is a substitute for male pig castration, with the end result being to prevent the pork from being smelling bad.
And yeah,
we talked briefly about another vaccine for smokers, and you're thinking, what does a vaccine have to do with smoking? But it again was something that was operating through the immune system to prevent the brain from getting the desired pleasure result or fulfillment of the addiction that comes from nicotine and cigarettes. And so if people aren't getting out of the cigarette what they're looking for, presumably it wouldn't make it easier for them to quit if it didn't drive them insane into suicide first. Well, I say that, you know, somewhat facetiously, but you have to consider
it's
that
true.
If somebody has to really want to quit, and they have to be willing to endure the withdrawal to get there. And there are a lot of smokers who try to quit more than once before they ever succeed or who never succeed. And I have to wonder if somebody sort of naively said, I'm going to take the vaccine here so that I will quit, and yet psychologically and or physiologically they're not in a place where they're really prepared to deal with the effects of no
nicotine.
Alan,
can we call that the super brain? Instead of the super bug, the super bug goes against, you know, it resists whatever it is that we're using as a method to suppress it. And our brain has the ability to do the same thing, really. It can rewire itself. Imagine that.
Yeah, because it'd be so much easier just to get a shot.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You get the shot that's supposed to suppress the brain from lighting up in all the right places, and so now you don't get the buzz, the high, whatever it is, the good feeling from smoking. But the brain says, hey, wait a minute, I really like that feeling. I'm going to rewire myself and get it somewhere else in my brain.
Oh, I got you. And the brain has amazing, that's what I was thinking about when you mentioned the brain earlier. I've heard stories about people who've literally had half of their brain removed for some disease or injury reason. And those people, some of them end up functioning perfectly normally. Ultimately, the brain has tremendous capability of compensating.
That's exactly right.
And so that's your point here. What if you... get the shot and it works, but then over time it doesn't work because the brain says, aha.
That's
and
right.
Interesting, very interesting point, Debbie. Well, be sure and stay tuned for our next exciting episode on the smoking vaccine. See how it plays out. Well, here's another one now. You're going to love this one. They call this the flab jab. The flab jab that could provide obesity breakthrough. And then this is, again, they're talking about a vaccine that works by stimulating the immune system to attack a hormone that promotes slow metabolism and weight gain. So, you know, outside of diet, they're saying that the options right now are surgery and strong drugs that can have serious side effects, and we could dispense with all of those and just give somebody a vaccine if this vaccine in development, you know, comes to market. There's this sort of implicit assumption that vaccines are completely, totally safe, and so obviously if the drugs have side effects, you do a vaccine and you've bypassed that entire problem. I find the assumption there rather, well, any number of adjectives we could put in there. Let's just say problematic. But it is sort of interesting at the same time. You know, they've working with mice at this point, and they have two different versions of the vaccine that they've studied, and each of them produced a sustained 10% reduction in body weight after the booster injections were administered after 3 weeks.
And now, the researchers are so thrilled, 10% reduction.
Yeah, well they are thrilled because we are a society, Western cultures, are societies of high levels of obesity and growing and increasing obesity, And childhood obesity, I think we've talked about this even a little bit, even though it's not really a vaccine issue. I think we've talked about it briefly in past shows. You know, this is a growing market, and in this particular case, no pun intended, the market of obesity, a growing market that, you know, the, many people, of course, there are many different weight loss systems out there, people making a living, developing, promoting weight loss systems, most of them diet-related, I suspect, but many different diets for weight loss. Dr. Meyer Eisenstein has a metabolic approach that he used himself to lose 100 pounds, and he's now out selling and promoting that. Obviously, it works if you can lose 100 pounds with it. What a great
And I'm sure he had a lot. He had a lot more going for him. I mean, he has a whole staff and a support system. I'm sure he changed his diet and he got out and did some more exercise. You know, it's just one component of a whole total system, and that's something that people need to recognize. Go ahead, keep going.
But how appealing would it be to somebody naive about the possible downside to say, gosh, I don't have to change what I eat, I don't have to do exercise, I don't have to go through a whole bunch of other hoops to, you know, get myself in shape, I'll just get a shot, you know, and get a booster 3 weeks later and, you know, however many shots it takes, 2, 3, 4 shots, you know, and then I'm done and, gosh, I could lose, you know, 10% of my weight. Well, for many people, 10% would for anybody who's overweight, any loss is probably a good thing, or any
right.
healthy loss is a good thing. Is 10%, you know, a figure that is significant enough, or is it going to replace the need to do any of the other things? I mean, I think your point is mm-hmm. well taken. Whatever the approach is, for most people, it really is going to have to be a multifaceted approach. But
and if you look at the photograph on this article, 10% is not going to be that much.
Not
I mean,
for that person.
For the person who needs 3 chairs to sit on, 10%, they're not going to even get down to 2 chairs. So it's something that needs really emotional support, relationship support, everything, you know, self-confidence. They need a lot of care to move in the right direction with their life. I also want to interject this information of my own personal. I think that God has put us on earth with a mission, and that is to overcome our challenges and our obstacles. If for one person it's smoking and another person it's the addiction to eating or eating the wrong foods or not getting enough exercise. And you know what? I just heard yesterday on the news that said if you are not standing up a good portion of the day, it's not healthy for your heart. So for me to be sitting here at the computer all day, it's not good for my heart. And the same way, we are built as human beings with these bodies that we need to move. And I just think that either the old adage of take a pill and you'll be better, or now the new one's going to be get a vaccine and you'll be better, is not going to be the answer. It's not going to work. That's not human nature, and that's not why we were put on this earth. That's my own little soapbox today.
Well, I think you can take that same theme, and whether you look at it theologically or scientifically, we have evolved or designed in a way that the allopathic approach of which often is really about taking shortcuts or trying to one up the design that we have. And if there's a way to improve on the human design, I'm all for it. You know, I'm not going to go so far as to say that the design is absolutely and totally not able to be helped or supported or improved. But I haven't seen any real evidence of that. I see the opposite with allopathic care, that the intervention approaches almost inevitably have a downside for whatever the alleged, and many times alleged as in ultimately unproven or disproven, upside. And it seems to miss the beauty of the exquisite design that we come in with and how superb it really, really is. And the beauty of, you know, I love an analogy that someone told me once that if the human body was a car and the oil light comes on, the allopathic approach is to disconnect the sensor as opposed to searching for the leak and plugging the leak and filling the oil level back up, which is would be a quote-unquote true healing as opposed to just treating a symptom. And I think it's a beautiful analogy because so often what happens is the allopathic approach is, first of all, treating a symptom rather than looking for a fundamental cause and doing a real genuine healing. But at the same time, sometimes the treatment of the symptom itself creates other problems. And it really, that whole philosophy in terms of approach to healthcare misses the totality of the body and the system and the synergy of all the different parts and systems and how they interact and interrelate and interwork. And what's the beauty of homeopathy, as I understand it, is that homeopathy seeks to support that system in working and functioning optimally rather than intervening and one-upping it. So I'll just add that piece of my philosophy to yours, and let's see if we can
was there anything else about this obesity one, or we're on to the next bit of information?
Let's move on to the next one here. There's so much here that's fascinating. I'm going to go to an article here that's from the source is the Bolin Report. This comes from consumer advocate Tim Bolin, which is a really modest term for this guy. His web address is bolinreport.com. Tim is an excellent writer, and he has regular reports that he posts on his website and emails out if you want to get on his email list, and I am a proud recipient of his emails. He keeps up with a lot of what's going on in litigation around the country and in alternative health. And this particular article, "Tension Increases, Federal Judge Orders CDC to Produce Secret Documents." Now, he's talking about what he's calling the most important court case about autism that's currently being litigated. This is a vaccine injury case, I believe, the Hooker v. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when somebody believes that they have a condition that is a vaccine injury, they can file a petition with the Federal Vaccine Injury Compensation Program and get themselves into a federal court system that's designed specifically for vaccine injury cases. Well, we had a backlog of cases a couple of years ago or so to the tune of something like 5,400 cases waiting to be heard in these courts, and it would take God knows how many years for the court to get to those one by one. So they did something. They had what they called autism omnibus proceedings, where they looked at the research on vaccines and autism and concluded on the basis of just a small handful of studies that vaccines don't cause autism, and dispensed with just an enormous number of cases where we're not compensated. So heavy politics here. So Tim's claim in this article, and I can certainly vouch for this to the extent that I've done related research on my own and seen other things supporting this, that basically the CDC's, he says, were six test cases and having to do three from the MMR vaccine causes autism issue and three from the thimerosal and the vaccines causes autism. And the judges relied completely on, for all six of these cases, on the validity of five studies ordered and run by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, we've talked before on this show how April a year ago, Paul Forson, the guy who was tasked with heading up that, and he was an author on at least one of the studies, and they concluded that vaccines don't cause autism, and the studies they pulled together showed that as well. He was a little over a year ago indicted on 13 counts of fraud with the CDC and 11 counts of 9 counts of money laundering, which brought into question, as far as I'm concerned, that whole series of studies. And Tim, in this article, Tim Bowen is taking another angle in this as well, which is just fascinating. So there was a biochemist scientist by the name of Brian Hooker, a PhD, who in late 2004, after having looked carefully for the CDC's so-called evidence that thimerosal, which is mercury, was safe and effective as a preservative in vaccines, and looking at the available studies, he just adamantly disagreed. No, these studies are coming to unsupportable conclusions. So he began to communicate with the CDC, and as you might expect, he was completely stonewalled. Spent 6 years trying to get information. They wouldn't give him information, but he didn't give up. So what Tim says is they were playing a little trick. They knew that the people who created the fake studies would also try to cover their tracks in any way they could. So they decided to set up a trap, and as Tim says it, the CDC walked right into it. So what is the trap? It turns out that this Dr. Hooker already had many of the documents that he was asking the court for, I mean asking the CDC for, that he was being denied, and he knew where more of the studies were stored. And he had at one point at least been promised access, but that was ultimately denied. The CDC keeps saying there aren't any studies, the documents don't say anything pertinent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this has now come up in a court case in the federal vaccine court system. And there are procedures, of course, in court systems where you ask for information from either side. Unless they've got a good reason not to give it, they have to give it to you, anything that's relevant to the case. So long story short here, the court in this case has issued an order. The judge is now has reached the point in this case where the judge is suspicious of what's really going on here. So the defendants, this would be the Department of Health and Human Services, and are directed now by order to deliver documents for what's called an in-camera inspection by the court. Now, that means the court's going to look at this outside of the courtroom and off the record to make a determination whether there's a reason the information can properly be excluded or whether the information is not admissible as evidence for some appropriate reason under the law. Here's what Tim says the judge's order actually means, that under the Freedom of Information Act, it authorizes agencies to withhold information related solely to the internal personnel rules and practices of an agency. So now the judge is in effect saying, show me where this rule applies in these communications. And, of course, the information...
What's the rule? What's the rule that they want?
The rule says they don't have to give any information about their internal personnel rules and practices of the agency. But that's not what they're asking for. They're asking for research information.
Okay.
So the judge is effectively saying to the defendants, show me why this information qualifies under the rule that allows you to say no, you know,
okay,
when asked for it. And what's interesting, if you're in a situation in a court case where you already have information you're looking for, let's say in this case, some of the information you're looking for, you are still allowed to ask for it, and the other side still has to produce it. And you might say, well, why should they have to give you what you already have? Well, the answer is, especially if they don't know you already have it, you want to see if they're going to produce the real documents or fake documents.
Right.
So if you already have some documents and you ask the other side, now this is not what Tim says in his article. This is just my additional comment.
Are they allowed to withhold the fact that they already had the documents to compare?
The people asking for documents don't have to say, we want these even though we already have them.
Okay.
But you can ask the other side to produce anything that they have or can reasonably get that is relevant to the case.
Right.
And then they have to provide it, or they have to give you a reason as to why they qualify for one of the limited exceptions that allow you to say, no, thank you.
Okay.
And so, of course, Tim has this now out on an article, and I assume the other side knows, even if they didn't originally, that the side asking for documents has some of them. But my point is, even though you have them, one of the reasons you might ask for them is to see if they'll give you what you know they have, first of all.
Right, that's the trap part. That's the trap, right. That's to confirm that they're, it's to show their character, their quality, you know, whether they're ethical, whether they're providing truthful information to you. By saying, please show us the information without letting them know that we already have the documents. And so what happened from this?
Well, here's where all this is going. Now, the deadline for the providing all this is tomorrow, so we'll have to see. Tension mounts, the plot thickens. Stay tuned for our next exciting episode. All of that. So we'll have to see where it goes. But let me explain where all this is going, because the summary here is really the cherry on top of all of this. The search for documents in this court case is aimed at uncovering a pattern of criminal activity. Whoever's making the decisions to withhold documents that the CDC, according to Tim, knows where all this is going. So he says, I'm certain that within the walls of the CDC, right this minute, certain CDC employees, past and present, contractors and consultants, etc., are quietly being told to personally, quote-unquote, lawyer up. I love the phrase. I've never heard it put that
way. Lawyer up means to get yourself a lawyer really fast.
You better get yourself a lawyer because we're in hot water. You know,
they can't leave the country, huh?
Well, maybe they better if they can. I don't know. But it's funny because I've never heard the expression lawyer up, but I love it. Anyway, and familiarize themselves with how to plead the Fifth, which means to make a claim under the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment gives you the right to say, I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me.
Right.
So the beauty of Tim's skill as a writer is that he has a real, sometimes witty and humorless way of sharing the information that he shares. And so his information is not only well-researched and quite informative, it's entertaining to read.
Throws in a little bit of irony in there.
He does whenever he can. So is there any...
Yeah,
I'm sorry, what?
Couple of people on Dr. Bob on the chat, he wrote a little bit ago that vaccines are an epidemiological hedge against disease. Any reasonable scientist knows that it will never protect 100% of those inoculated. Many of the so-called protected diseases induce less than 50% immunity. While we were saying it's, you know, up to 30%, doesn't provide protection, and many are harmed by the vaccination. Vaccines are a political hedge against mass lawsuits saying that the government didn't do enough to prevent said epidemic. So it's true. We live, you know what? I have people who live in other parts of the world that say they don't like Americans simply because we are the country that sues. And that's the way they've, you know, it used to be many years ago, we're the country with a McDonald's on every, a hamburger joint on every corner. And now it's we're the country that sues everybody else. So
we certainly are a high litigation society. There's no question about that. I've never heard of an instance, though, where the government has been held accountable for much of anything, frankly, but in particular for allowing or not preventing infectious disease outbreak. And one of the great failings of our governments at all levels, in my personal opinion, is the high level of immunity that government has from suit.
Absolutely.
And I've had experienced in my own practice, I had a case where, I mean, the government is not immune absolutely from suit, but it's really limited. And I had a client who was accidentally, total accident on the part of a clerk, but the clerk made an error, and my client ended up in jail for something he didn't do and had a horrible experience. And here in North Carolina, the law says you can sue a clerk for negligence. So, of course, it was not personal, but my client deserved some kind of compensation for this horrible experience, traumatic experience, frankly. And the case got thrown out of court, not because there was any problem with the case, in my opinion. In fact, the opposing side, which in this case would have been an attorney from the Attorney General's office representing the state in this case, the clerk of a county court, really didn't, and I mean no disrespect to that person or the Attorney General's office, but really didn't even make a complete defense, and I think the judge just threw it out for political reasons. Nobody's going to sue a clerk in my court. So even where you have technically the option to sue the government, good luck, because, you know, good luck finding a judge who will let that case go forward. It's just, it's a serious problem. And what that ultimately means is that people in government can do what they want to, whether they're supposed to or not, whether they're allowed to or not. Now, you know, we can joke about that and say, yeah, like that's something new. Just look at Congress or look at the president. There were no weapons of mass destruction or whatever. We joke about it. But it's actually something in my experience and in my perception that is pervasive throughout our different layers, local, state, and federal systems of government, in probably legislative and judicial branches, and certainly the executive branch. It's not that everybody is always corrupt all the time, but it's that it's an element that is persistently there, and it's a really serious flaw, I think, that we can't hold these people accountable for their unlawful behavior.
Well, to cover all of that, I would say we don't live in a healthy society today. It goes across the board with the financial situation, with our increase in mental depression, with the increase in use of drugs for disease, sociologically, culturally, every way. You know, we are not living in a healthy society, so that infects also the criminal elements and the judicial system that we have.
I agree, but I think it's even more concentrated when you are dealing with issues and positions of power and control, that the more power or control there is in a given position, whether it's a government position or a position in industry, that the more power available, the more that position attracts the people who want to be there in one part and often large part for the sake of power and control, and often in order to wield that power control to a personal agenda, or in any event an agenda other than the one the position is at least ostensibly designed for. So it's the old
yes. I know what you're going to say.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely kind of thing.
I was going to repeat that quote for you. And we don't have very many minutes left in the show, but in the chat we were asked there about the European decision concerning the MMR vaccine and the relationship to autism. And that was on May 23rd, 2012, that an Italian court holds the MMR vaccine linked to autism. There is a translation of that from the Italian into English, if anybody wants to read it, on childhealthsafety.wordpress.com. And basically, autism cases are being put into the spotlight. Someone in the Rimini District Court says the fault of the vaccine. And what's going to happen with this compensation, we're going to find out. I don't think that anything has been determined as yet. But basically, if this goes through, the MMR is the same vaccine that's given all around the world in all different countries. It's not only confined to Italy. And so we're going to have to see how the rest of the countries are going to change their position on it.
Well, it's not the same vaccine that's used all over the world. There are different companies that manufacture the vaccine, so there potentially could be differences in the vaccines and claims with regard to specific vaccines. But I can only speculate, but I honestly don't think that's going to have any impact at all on the vaccine autism connection here, because the official view here is not driven by science, it's driven by politics, and a single isolated case is not going to change the politics. But we have something more profound than that, in my opinion, already here right in the U.S. We had an article published last year in a law review journal. The researchers in that matter had gone through cases right here in the U.S. in the vaccine injury compensation program, They did not by any means go through all of the cases to date. They just went through a sampling, and I don't know what percentage they covered, but they found in their sampling, I think it was 83 cases, vaccine-injured, compensated by the government cases. In other words, the government said, yes, in these instances, the injury was caused by a vaccine. And 83 cases with autistic kids who have been compensated. So, you know, from the point of view of the people representing the petitioners, the attorneys representing the petitioners, they know not to use the word autism if you want to get compensated. So you use whatever other diagnosis and labels you can, and then you can potentially get compensated. If you use the word autism, you'll be rejected. So
were these were cases where symptoms of autism were not labeled as autism, and then they were compensated?
These are cases over the history. The thing I just said now applies to very recent and current cases.
Okay.
Because of in 2010, the omnibus autism proceedings came to the conclusion, we now, many of us know and believe anyway, that it was because of fraudulent studies, but officially, we now know, quote-unquote officially, we now know that vaccines don't cause autism. I believe nothing can be further from the truth, and there's substantial evidence in the medical literature, and this court case in Italy would be, you know, part of the evidence as well. But right here in the U.S., over the course of the injury compensation program, which went into effect in the late 1980s, we know that there are many, many cases of children who are compensated for vaccine injury who have autism. So that in and of itself is not, in an absolute sense, proof that vaccines cause autism, but it is very, very strong support and evidence. It means that the whole question about vaccines and autism is not by any means resolved just because somebody at the CDC says it is, or a small handful of studies, especially that when closely scrutinized, do not hold up. The studies don't hold up to scrutiny. They clearly were, now Tim Bowling goes so far as to call them fraudulent. Well, I don't know if there's any, you know, softer word that applies. If you are manipulating anything in a study in order to reach a predetermined outcome, I think fraud is the right word. But in any event, there's plenty of information to unravel this whole front that the CDC has about vaccines and autism. And if this case proceeds forward, as Tim Bowen is suggesting, that case is going to potentially blow this whole issue wide open. And it's about time, is all I have to say about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm looking forward to finding out what happens in next week's series. We have no time left today, so we're going to say goodbye. And I want folks to know that Alan is willing and able and would like to speak wherever you are in the country and inform you about your rights and about waivers and exemptions. And he's the person on the cutting edge. Okay. See you next week, Alan. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Debbie. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Dreaming for the great new love and healing for mankind. Your truth.